Yes, macroeconomics can be hard, but the law of unintended consequences does not grade on a curve. From American Public Media, this is Market Flags. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, 23 June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with presidential proclamation number 10014, the official title of which is Proclamation Suspending Entry of Aliens Who Present a Risk to the U.S. Labor Market Following the Coronavirus Outbreak. In somewhat more plain language, President Trump has decided to stop hundreds of thousands of foreign workers from getting jobs in this economy. The restriction on work visas are in place through the end of the year, although renewable, and they apply to a whole lot of highly skilled jobs, usually in STEM fields, also those seasonal hospitality workers and students on summer work study programs. Two stories on this story to start things off today, the common theme of which is, you know, sometimes things don't work out the way you think they're gonna. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino is up first.
The idea behind cutting off visas is that American companies will hire Americans. But it's often not that simple. Foreign workers help the economy, says Giovanni Peri, an economist at the University of California, Davis.
These workers are allowing this company to grow, to improve their productivity. They are connected with other jobs, which Americans are doing.
He's found cities that have higher numbers of immigrants working in STEM fields on H-1B visas for specialty occupations also have more job and wage growth for American workers. And when companies can't hire workers from abroad, they often simply move the jobs instead, says Britta Glennon, a professor of management at University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
So those jobs aren't necessarily going to Americans. It just means that those jobs are going to another country.
She found restrictions on H-1B visas led firms to move more jobs to China, India, and Canada during the early 2000s. But allowing companies to hire more immigrants doesn't necessarily slow the exporting of jobs overseas, says Ron Hira, a professor of political science at Howard University and author of Outsourcing America.
So the net effect of H-1Bs is to speed up offshoring.
He says of the top 30 companies that receive the most H-1B visas, half of them are staffing firms that send jobs abroad.
So they have the U.S. workers train the H-1B workers who then return home. And so their ultimate aim is to try to shift the work offshore as much as possible.
He advocates reforms to the immigration system to limit such abuses while still allowing for innovation and growth. But Wharton's Britta Glennon says the limits put in place by the Trump administration could change the course of business for years or even decades to come.
If it becomes too difficult to hire people in your U.S. office, you may shift more than just those immigrant jobs abroad.
She says once companies start moving jobs, the innovation that fuels growth goes along with them. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
So let's take a slice of the American labor force, because that's what immigration is, right? It's a labor story. Let's take a slice and apply this new Trump administration rule to it, as well as, of course, the rule of unintended consequences. A category of work visa known as H-1B, as Megan was saying, is among the visas that have been shut off. It's among the biggest categories of work visas, and it is used by, among other industries, healthcare. And as Marketplace's Jasmine Garz reminds us, we got a pandemic going on.
Dr. Mukesh Gopalakrishnan is an emergency cardiologist at a retirement community an hour outside of Tucson, Arizona.
I'm the only cardiologist who's there at least 5 days in a week.
These days, he sees a lot of COVID-19 patients. He was born in India and is here on an H-1B visa. In America, around 28% of doctors, 35% of home aides, and 20% of nursing assistants are foreign-born. For many international medical students, the way to stay in the U.S. after graduation is by serving at risk communities. That includes rural areas, much like where Dr. Gopalakrishnan is practicing. Last year, rural areas accounted for 66% of the health professional shortage areas. Richard Burke is with Envoy Global, which prepares visa applications for businesses like hospitals. He says the issue is simply supply and demand.
U.S. citizens, students, are not graduating in the requisite levels with STEM degrees to address this shortage, which is only going to get more profound.
The Trump administration has said the freeze on work visas will protect jobs that could go to American workers. Masa Kambabi, an attorney with the American Immigration Lawyers Association, says that won't happen.
You need these H-1B physicians who are willing to go to Alabama, you know, Georgia, you know, parts of the Beltway that just don't have enough doctors. And now this sends a signal to all of them, look, we don't care about you. We don't want you to come here and work in the United States.
And she's worried the visa freeze will push them to get jobs in other countries. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
This quick item, immigration adjacent. It's from the Marketplace desk of, yeah, I guess turnabout is fair play. The New York Times reports today that as the European Union prepares to reopen its borders, a draft list of countries whose nationals will not be welcome to travel to the European Union because they failed to control the virus. That list includes Russia, Brazil, and the United States. There was a little agita in the markets overnight, but all was well once the bell sounded. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a bit of a set to last night, a bit of back and forth, some cross-trade policy wires, I guess you'd say. The guy who is nominally in charge of this administration's trade policy, that'd be Peter Navarro, the director of the National Trade Council, said on Fox News yesterday that the U.S.-China trade deal was over. It's over, is what he said. A couple 3 hours later, Navarro had said the videotape had quoted him out of context. National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow had said the trade deal is not dead. And their boss had taken to his favorite social media website and said it is, in fact, firmly intact, that deal. The futures markets had a modified freakout till the whole thing was over. But then this morning, the World Trade Organization said global trade in the second quarter had dropped 18.5% compared to a year ago. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on the trade desk today.
For context, that big a drop in trade is really bad. Here's WTO Director General Roberto Azevedo in a YouTube video.
It will be the steepest on record. But there is an important silver lining here. The fall in trade could have been much worse.
Earlier estimates had trade falling more than 30% this year. Now it looks like the hit will be closer to 13%. Trade is about people wanting stuff in one country, then parts and labor coming together from other countries to get that thing to them. But that's tough to do in a pandemic.
There's five different countries involved in making a blue widget with white polka dots.
Christine McDaniel is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center.
And if one of those countries is not operating at full capacity, then the rest of the supply chain either has to slow down or stop or find an alternative.
Earlier in the pandemic, a lot of trade just stopped. But now, says Jeffrey Gertz at the Brookings Institution,
now we're entering this new phase where there seems to be these rolling blackouts of countries turning on and off their economies, going in and out of lockdowns.
Even as economies in Europe and the U.S. reopen, for now, more cases and lockdowns in Brazil, India, and sub-Saharan Africa create more disruptions. Dauda Jawara is with Africa-focused investment firm Altica Partners. He gives the example of a key port in Kenya.
Ships aren't coming into Mombasa, then raw materials and finished materials aren't being sold and distributed in Kenya, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, all of the kind of inland countries.
Keeping trade flowing requires countries to keep the virus under control. But that's a big if. So the WTO and other trade groups create a best-case scenario, a worst-case scenario, and cross their fingers. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We're, what now, 3 days into the summer of 2020? And for those for whom summer jobs are an economic necessity, well, sorry. Last year, this time, with unemployment at record lows, more than half of 16 to 24-year-olds had a summer job. Not so here in this pandemic economy. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on that one.
Maybe you've been to camp or your kids have. You know, arts and crafts, swimming, bug bites, and of course, the camp song.
Rock for camp forever, firm together stand.
Raylee Schlatter has been going to Rockbrook Camp for Girls in North Carolina since she was 10. She's 22 now, and this would have been her fifth summer as a counselor. Would have been, because camp is canceled.
Sincerity. So Rockbrook Camp in all our hearts will stand for loyalty.
Schlatter is an English lit major at Auburn University in Alabama, and the $3,300 she makes every summer usually helps her pay for books.
Which doesn't go very far because textbooks are expensive.
But it's not just money she'll miss out on. Schlatter wants to be a teacher, and she says camp helps her build leadership skills.
It gives me the opportunity to create bonds with these campers. A lot of times these girls are looking for role models.
This summer is going to be hard on a lot of young people who are counting on being able to get a job, especially in travel, tourism, and restaurants, which hire a lot of seasonal workers.
What happens to a seasonal economy when the season doesn't come?
That's Betsy Stevenson, a former chief economist with the Labor Department.
What we'll actually see is not the season not coming, but it coming in such a partial way that there is a lot of permanent job destruction.
And it reaches far beyond young people, to workers who take on second jobs in the summer and teachers who use the season to earn extra cash. And for a lot of businesses in vacation towns, summer isn't just the season. It's the only season. Tour operators, bike rentals, and boardwalk shops typically close for winter.
This year is going to be a tough year financially. There's no ands, ifs, or buts.
Mark Novata manages Wequosset Resort on Cape Cod. He usually brings in around 500 employees to work as housekeepers, servers, and groundskeepers. Nearly all of them are seasonal and come back year after year. This summer, he thinks he'll have to cut hiring in half because bookings are way down.
We're going to onboard as demand grows, but we don't know exactly what that demand will be.
A lot of businesses, like sports franchises, don't know if there will be any demand at all. Sarah El-Khalili is 20 and will be a senior at UC Santa Cruz in the fall. She was supposed to work for the LA Dodgers Foundation this summer, but with the season disrupted, she's out of a job.
I've been working every summer since I was 17, so it is definitely a really tough situation.
She says she looked everywhere for work, but didn't have any luck. So instead,
I decided to take classes. Well, I didn't really have a choice.
Then she got an internship with an education nonprofit. She'll work fewer hours and won't make as much as she would have with the Dodgers. But the internship could help her when she applies to grad school in the fall. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up,
2020 is probably going to be the most challenging year for Chinese companies ever.
Oh, it's a challenging year everywhere, gang. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 131 points today, 0.5%, 26,156. The NASDAQ up 74 points, 0.75%, 10,131 on the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 up 13. About 0.4%, 31.31. Their meat alternative producer Beyond Meat lost more than 4% today. Starbucks picked rival Impossible Foods, maker of the Impossible Burger, for its summer menu meatless breakfast sandwich. Say that 10 times fast. Beyond Meat, you recall, went public in May of last year. Impossible Foods is private. Starbucks up 0.1% today. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Megan and Jasmine were laying out earlier in the program what President Trump's new limits on work visas might mean for this economy because, to repeat myself, immigration is a labor force story. We are going to turn now, though, to some immigration history, how we used to let people come to America and how that relates to some of what is happening today. Jia Lin Yang's new book about her family and the changes we have made to immigration laws through the years is called One Mighty and Irresistible Tide. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, first of all, how your parents came to the United States?
They came as students, really. So they grew up in Taiwan
And in their 20s, they came to the U.S. for graduate education, my dad in economics, my mom in science. And they then decided to stay and build a life here. And for me, I never really knew the story of why they were allowed to stay. I sort of took that part for granted. But the story of them coming for their education, then settling in, being married, having me, that was always the story.
The backstory, of course, is the immigration law of 1965. Yeah. How did they how did that benefit them, I guess, is the question.
So our entire family is here. My mom's siblings are here. They have kids of their own. And essentially, the story of why everyone is here is traced back to this law. And I think that's the case for many Americans, especially Asian Americans. This law was really important because it basically said we're not going to be picking immigrants based on their ethnicity anymore. In the past, the government had prioritized people from Northern and Western Europe to deter people from countries that they thought were undesirable. And so in 65, they eliminated that form of discrimination and instead said, you know, if you already have someone coming here, this is what the Trump administration calls chain migration, their sibling, their parent, their child gets priority to get a visa. And it really is why the demographics of this country are changing so rapidly.
It has to be pointed out that this law comes amid the Civil Rights Act of the mid-1960s and the protests, and yet somehow gets subsumed, right? It does kind of get lost, which you say in your introduction.
It's a kind of a little-known law from this time, I'd say, or relatively little-known. I think it's increasingly recognized as an important one. I think probably because the people who wrote it didn't realize how significant it would be either. You know, for them, it was this capstone achievement to rectify discrimination against, in particular, Jewish and Italian Americans. But no one thought that through the way that this law would reshape our immigration system, that America's racial demographics would be changed forever. That was not on people's minds.
There is certainly now, and I'll leave it to you to explain how it might have existed in the past, but a tension between the family reunification motivation for American immigration policy and the desire of getting skilled immigrants to this country. Does that play in this law and in the decades since?
It's a really critical piece of the history. The thing to remember is that for a long time, we essentially had open borders. But over time, starting in the 50s, we began to sort of add these requirements and ways of thinking about, you know, do we want people who are highly skilled? And in 65, there was this huge debate over, okay, if you're not going to do ethnic quotas, how are we going to pick who's going to come into this country? And they arrived at family, interestingly, as a way of keeping the country more white. In fact, at first, they wanted to prioritize skills, but they switched it and said, let's actually prioritize families because that'll protect the white ethnic identity of this country. And ever since then, most of the green cards that are issued are based on family ties. And now the Trump White House, of course, is really trying to change that. You know, they keep claiming that this is because of the pandemic, it's because of the economic fallout. And so they constantly talk about chain migration. And our laws, I think they realize, are exactly why this country's demographics have changed so much in ways that I think we haven't really fully grappled with. We just sort of assume that we've always been a nation of immigrants. But I think when you look at the history, you begin to see the ways in which we're constantly choosing who can come in, who cannot, who has the right papers, who doesn't. Each of these decisions is a very political fight, and we're just in the middle of that all over again now.
Jillian Yang is a deputy national editor at the New York Times. Her book is called One Mighty and Irresistible Tide. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me so much.
Jillian's book is out now. We've got an excerpt at marketplace.org about why the practical effects of that law were so much different than anybody had been guessing. You know how I've been saying since this pandemic started that it's exposing some of the troubling underlying realities of this economy? Some of them big, like inequality and racism. Some of them a little bit less big, supply chain problems and the like. Same thing is happening elsewhere in the world, in China for sure. Shops and businesses, most of them anyway, are open. And the talk is turning to practicalities, like getting paid. And as Marketplace's Jennifer Pack reports now from Shanghai, that is not a new problem over there.
At a Starbucks in Shanghai, Wang Xiaojian is on the phone. He runs a company that supplies pumps and pipes to food and pharmaceutical factories. Since the coronavirus outbreak, he chases clients to pay overdue bills once a week.
About a third of my clients don't pay on time. That was true even before the pandemic hit. Some won't transfer the money unless I remind them.
So far, he says, he's only had one client default on payment. He took the firm to court and won, but still hasn't seen the money he's owed. For him, it's all about what the Chinese call guanxi, personal trust and connections.
That's how you do business in China. We operate on mutual trust. Contracts are useless. The courts can't do much for us either.
He says he can't be too picky about clients. Business hasn't been as good in the downturn of the past few years. There's too much competition and less easy credit. Zhang Baoguo owns a fabric trading company in eastern Zhejiang province.
In 2014, payments would arrive 1 month after we delivered. That became 45 days, then 3 months. Now payments take 6 months or longer.
And that's risky for businesses. If a client delays payment for more than 6 months, there's an 80% chance he won't pay, says Asia economist Carlos Casanova with the credit insurance firm Coface.
When you already have accumulated a payment delay, and this accounts for a large proportion of your annual turnover, 10%, then you are in a situation where if there's an exogenous shock like COVID-19, you might stumble into cash flow difficulties.
Out of some 1,000 companies he surveyed in China last year, 66% said their clients delayed payments. He expects the situation will be worse this year.
2020 is probably going to be the most challenging year for Chinese companies ever, with growth expected to drop, according to our forecasts, to 1% in 2020. That is quite unprecedented.
The COVID-19 crisis has wiped out overseas orders for fabric trader Zhang Baoguo. But, he says, he has some domestic orders that should keep him afloat. He admits, though, he has a lot more time to go fishing these days. Back at Starbucks, factory equipment supplier Wang Xiaojian says he's more proactive about chasing debt nowadays, but he doesn't push too hard.
Chinese people care a lot about relationships. If I chase my clients too aggressively, it might hurt their self-esteem. They'll say, "I never said I won't pay you."
He says find an excuse. A good time to chase debts in China is the end of the lunar year when businesses need to close their books. The practice is so common that before the Lunar New Year back in January and days before the pandemic shut down much of China's economy, you could hear on public transport people chasing debt or, like this businessman, being asked to pay up.
You need to send me an invoice. You only sent me a picture of your bank card. How do I know how much money I owe you?
Humor can help too. Businessman Zhang Peng, who sells lights, posted a video on Douyin, the Chinese version of TikTok.
Dear clients, who owe me money?
He points the camera to a bowl of rice topped with Lao Ganma chili sauce.
Take a look at this. Without money, I can only afford Lao Ganma chili sauce on my rice.
Please, he says, send your payment to me as soon as you can. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I'm going to go to the Transportation Security Administration well one more time. As you know, it's one of my key indicators in this whole thing. TSA passenger throughput for yesterday and a year ago yesterday. We are over 600,000 people who are feeling good enough about what's going on to fly. 607,000, actually, the first time north of 600K since March. Yes, a year ago yesterday, it was 2.7 million, but, you know, progress. Not for nothing, but Molly Wood and I were talking to a doctor about this pandemic on our podcast this morning, Make Me Smart. It's called the podcast. Check it out. Anyway, he said, this doctor did, you know, all precautions being taken, he would fly. All right, we are out of here, but not without a moment of economic context. We got numbers on May home sales this week, new home sales this morning to be specific, up almost 13% in May from a year ago. And in closely related news, mortgage rates about as low as they have ever been. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Eliza Mills, and Janet Wynn. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand, and I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.